May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. Today it's Tassajara Stories. I'm D.C. Pupa of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free from economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the confines of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. I'm going to read three pieces today for the work in progress Tassajara Stories, the early years with Shunryu Suzuki. I could just read one of these at a time, but I could read one of them instead of one of the brief memories, but this is the way I'm doing it. I try to read about 8 pages, single space. This is 9. So we'll see how it goes. So we'll get right into it after the pause to meditate. So when you hear the bell, if you feel like it, hit pause and meditate or whatever for as long as you wish. And when you're ready to come back, hit unpause. And then we'll be here to hit the bell and end the meditation and we'll get right into these Tassajara stories. Rowdy. In the summer, we had a charge for day visitors. Eventually, we set a limit. There had come to be too many people, and it wasn't fair to the overnight guests or the students. In 1972, we bought the Jamesburg House, where the dirt road begins, put up a large sign announcing, "That's where day guests register and pay." And then they'd have the unpleasant task of sending folks away when the limit was reached. People learned to call ahead. In the case of those who didn't notice the sign or who came anyway when it was full, it depended on whom they met. A lot of students at the gate would just say, "Sorry, but you can't come in." Another student might weaken and tell them to go on in but make a reservation next time. They might suggest go up creek, where few go. Dennis Kelly, a friend of Alan Marlowe's who came to visit, did the student's schedule, including work. One day he was on landscaping near the gatehouse when some happy hippies bounced up saying they wanted to go down creek. But they had no money. The person at the gate told them they could get there via the horse pasture trail a couple of miles up the road. They said, "Oh, come on, let us go downstream. You don't own it. We'll be good." They got no mercy. Dennis overheard and said he'd pay for them. The gatekeeper objected, but Dennis went and got the money, and that was it. He had plenty of it, and he was a major manufacturer of LSD. When he left, the woman he was with dropped a $500 bill into the donation box. That was 1969, the last year those were in circulation. Backpackers walking through, we did not refuse or charge. We couldn't. It's open trail. Hunters the same, though we asked them to unload their guns and hold them pointed down while walking or riding horses. Actual serious hunters I found to be a good lot, respectful of the forest and safety. But there are the undisciplined guys with booze and guns during hunting season. And there are guys who just like to carry guns and use them anywhere regardless of the season. I can remember once over by Arroyo Seco, walking up to a man with an automatic weapon like you see in movies. He'd been unloading it. He'd been unloading it randomly into the hillside across the river. Pardon me, sir, I said, but I'd appreciate it if you didn't fire that thing like that. I have friends over there coming in on a trail. I added that a teenage acquaintance, when I was growing up, had killed a man by shooting randomly and illegally into a national forest in Colorado. They learned what they'd done when the man's son came running out crying. Two couples were the caretakers of Tassajara when we bought it. Bill was a tall, serious fellow with a mustache. One day there were shots coming from Grasshopper Flats. Bill and Jim walked out to see what was up. There were a couple of guys, one with a bottle of Jack Daniels and the other with a rifle shooting at trees. Bill went up to them and said that they were on private property and that they had to go elsewhere to use the gun. "Yeah, and who's gonna stop me?" the guy said, pointing his rifle at Bill. "I am," said Bill, stepping up to him and taking the rifle. "I'll keep it in the office for you." No. A category of folks who could come in any time for free was, of course, public servants. Forest rangers, sheriffs, building and health inspectors. Didn't happen much. We were so remote. We'd offer them baths, food, tours. Usually they'd just want a cup of coffee, but would accept a loaf of whole grain bread upon departure. Always had good relations with the powers that be. There was so much surveillance going on back then that we assumed undercover FBI agents were checking us out. We'd speculate on whether one of us was undercover. That would be an awfully demanding infiltration and unnecessary. It was brought up in a meeting. The general feeling was that they'd be welcome. I suggested we set aside one slot and send an invitation. The only disagreement was whether they should get a scholarship or not. "Okay, okay," said Peter. "Enough. Back to the meeting." A guy came in one day, desperate for sanctuary. He was hiding, he said, from what he feared was a Scientology hit squad. Said he was on their enemies list. He was holding on to me, saying, "You've got to help me, please." I had some day guests drive him out. Didn't tell him they were Scientologists. He was never seen or heard from again. Ah, just kidding. We let him be a guest student for a few days, and then he headed back out to the dangerous world to hide in the shadows. One group of four young drunk cowboys came in on horseback, whooping it up and shooting their guns in the air. One took his horse down the steps into the swimming pool. Two of them went into the women's side of the baths. This was 1971 guest season when I was assistant director. They were on their way to go camping and boat hunting in the woods. 5 days later, they came back and were drunk again. Before I could deal with them, Mark Alexander just went up to them as soon as they got there and told them to keep moving. They did. Once the guest season ended, there were signs at Jamesburg and at our gate saying we're closed. Every now and then we'd get someone who would have their minds made up that they should be there. One hippie told me he'd come there to meet God. I told him that God was everywhere and that he could just as easily meet God, say, on a walk to the pines opposite the horse pasture trailhead. That worked. During Sesshin, we were seriously shut. One persistent, dreadlocked fellow insisted he'd not be in the way, just wanted to soak in the hot water. I told him there were three basic times at Tassajara. There was the guest season, when we were open to guests, and at that time, and the interims, we were open to guest students and were pretty flexible. I said, that's like when you're hanging out with friends drinking a little beer. Everyone's welcome. For the practice periods, I told him, we were more selective. It's really just for us. But if someone shows up, we'll be friendly. That's like when you're getting really stoned with some friends on some good pot and don't want anyone to bring you down, but you can be flexible. But we're in Sesshin now, I said. That's 7 days straight Zazen, Zen meditation, from early in the dark to late at night. That's like an acid trip. We've got the set and the mental setting under control, and we don't want any distraction at all, even from friends. We're in Sesshin now. He nodded. I walked him to his VW bug, and we bowed in parting. Sometimes I'd fail. One poor lost soul had tried to convince me he should be able to stay during a practice period, and when nothing I said worked, I took him to Katagiri. He sat with Katagiri for a while and on his way out said he'd met a real compassionate Zen master, and then looking at me, he added, not like that uptight bureaucrat asshole I talked to first. A couple of super tough Hell's Angels came in one day during practice period. They were polite, but they made people nervous. Found Tommy. His years of heroin, speed, female impersonation, and low-life dives came in handy. He hung comfortably and gently with them, fed them, took them to the bath, special treatment. But we were all glad Tommy was being host. In the fall of 1967, during a seven-day Sesshin, four young loud guys came walking into Tassajara. Most of us were in the Zendo, but I was on a meal server's break, hanging up my Oriyogi cloths to dry on the lines by the shop, and heard them on the road coming in. Said hi and let them know that we're closed for a meditation retreat. They were inebriated students from a Catholic junior college, I learned, trying to buddy up to them and get their cooperation as they kept walking in. The one who set the tone and did most of the talking for the group was hostile and vocal. He asked questions like, what's this Zen thing here? Do you have women? Can we fuck them? Do you know karate? Why can't we go to the hot baths if you guys are meditating? Do you think you could stop us? The only words of his I remember exactly are those from the strange phrase, you telling us to make our bird, make our bird? Silas Hoadley and Norman Stiegelmeyer came up from the Zendo. Silas calmly deflected the hostility by talking to the group of guys in his low-key, non-confrontational style. The hostile guy was not retreating, though. I started to bond with one I thought seemed to show some signs of being embarrassed by what was going on. Norman started talking to the hostel guy, who was still incensed that they were being asked to make our bird. Silas shifted his attention to the other two, who seemed ready to fight or leave, depending on which way the angry leader went. Norman was an artist and teacher from the San Francisco Art Institute who'd been sitting with Suzuki for years. He was lanky, friendly, and came across so differently, even strangely, from other people. His movements were sort of jerky, and he frequently seemed to be amazed by whatever was happening, and he was fearless. I could see that his presence was throwing Mr. Itching for a Drunken Brawl off balance. At one point, he asked Norman, "Do you Zen people believe in God?" Norman scratched his head, turned it from side to side, and replied, "Well, let me think. No, I don't guess we do." The ringleader looked startled. He took a step back. "What? Did you hear that, guys? They don't believe in God. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here." As he ran back up the road, he kept yelling, "They don't believe in God. They don't believe in God." And his relieved friends followed him out. I think he was more afraid of Norman than the God thing. We three went back to the Zendo. There were some fairly grubby, shifty-looking dudes that came in during guest season in what looked like an old UPS truck. Said they just wanted to look around. Didn't want anything, baths, food. Tim kept an eye on them, but not far enough. Not long after they drove off, a guest who'd gone up beyond the gate to fetch something from his car reported things stolen from it. A quick check revealed that all the unlocked cars had been gone through and some broken into. Tim walked to the office and called the sheriff. The thieves hadn't thought out their getaway route thoroughly. There's only one way out. It's at least 45 minutes away in what they were driving. The sheriff was waiting for them. A visitor people were truly... A visitor people were truly disturbed about was a guy who walked into the office and said, he just released 5,000 Black Widow spiders at Grasshopper Flats. Before panic could spread, Sterling Bunnell stepped in. He said not to worry about it, that in the first place, it's highly unlikely he'd have the 5,000 Black Widows in a jar. But even if he did and released them, that the area can support only so many, and the population would soon revert to the proper balance. It's always good to have Sterling around. He was especially good at how we deal with unwanted guests that weren't human. The garden had gophers. Bunnell brought in two long gopher snakes to deal with that issue. He must have forgotten to tell them to stay in the garden because a guest came into the office holding one of them and said his room was already occupied. Like it was a guest who knew his snakes and how to handle them because they looked somewhat like rattlesnakes without rattles. That wouldn't have stopped Bunnell, though. Once I told him I was going to the upper barn to look for a rattler that was there, and he eagerly came along, I was shocked to see him stick his hand under a cabinet there and feel around for it. He found it. We put it in a trash can, drove it up the road beyond the watershed of our creek, watched it slide down into the woods below. Thanks to Bunnell's tutelage, I confidently caught a few rattlesnakes at Tassajara after that. Unlike Bunnell, though, I wouldn't pick them up and stroke them. I'd guide them into an open trash can on its side, ride it, and drive them out. During the first guest season, Tim Bunkley was running the office. He came to the dining room and told me that a crazy guy with psychic power had come into Tassara not to let him get hold of my mind. He said the guy had been studying Kundalini and gone psychotic and had been instantly hypnotizing everyone he walked by. Tim said the guy came through the shop and upper garden just zapping everyone. Somebody ran to the office to warn him, so when the guy got to the office, Tim was prepared. Tim said that while they talked, that the guy was literally raping his mind and that he started internally chanting the Padmasambhava mantra and clung to it as hard as he could. He said that made the guy angry. He called Tim the weirdest person he'd ever met. Tim told him, "We don't do that stuff here," and told him to leave. The guy said, "Just try and get rid of me," and walked away. Tim was concerned the guy would be disturbing the students and throwing a monkey wrench into the workings of the guest season, and felt it was his responsibility to deal with this situation. Suzuki and some officers were at a city board meeting, and even Coburn was in Monterey seeing a doctor. I wasn't worried. I'd met a number of mind power trippers in my life, especially in the hippie world, without becoming their zombie. But on the other hand, good teachers haven't been able to get to me either. But Tim was a sensitive and serious person whom Suzuki wanted to ordain early on. Said that once he brought a sample of various drugs to a psychic in Boston, heroin, cocaine, speed, coffee, alcohol, marijuana, all hidden in containers. The psychic said that the pot was the most dangerous. He told me how he was in the pool in the creek outside the steam room when Suzuki crossed the bridge to go to the baths. That was before we made a special Abbott's bath time. Suzuki stopped and stood on the bridge looking at Tim. Tim said he felt self-conscious because he was sitting there in the creek, naked, looking at his teacher. Then Tim heard Suzuki's voice say, "Be yourself." Suzuki turned and continued walking into the baths. His mouth never moved, but I heard it, Tim said. Coburn came back and Tim got him involved. The guy was respectful of a Japanese priest and agreed that he'd leave. Bob Watkins and Coburn drove him out to Carmel. They stopped up at the first ridge to look at the view, and the guy jumped out of the car and over the side of the road into the chaparral and disappeared. A couple of hours later, he was back at Tassara. Coburn suggested they give him a room and wait for Suzuki. The next day, Suzuki arrived, went to the Zendo to offer incense and bow, and as he walked out, Tim was waiting. They sat outside the office and talked a while. Tim went back in to answer the phone, and from there he saw the madman run up to Suzuki. "I don't know if Suzuki even said anything," he said. But their encounter was incredibly brief, like 5 seconds, and the guy turned around and ran out the driveway, never to be seen again. Meg. "I went to a talk by Suzuki Roshi Saturday morning," Meg said. "I don't remember what it was on, but I was transformed. I said to myself, oh goodness, this man knows more than all my brilliant Brandeis professors put together. I'm going to practice with him." I just vowed right then and there to study with Suzuki Roshi. 6 months later, I was at Tassajara. Meg Goller went back to the East Coast and gathered her stuff. She dropped out of college and gave up her passion of dance as well. Because, she said, I felt that Zazen sitting perfectly still was the ultimate dance. After spending half a year sitting at Sokoji, she was accepted for the practice period, which would begin in January. She arrived at Tassajara toward the end of December of 1968 and did the initiatory Tangaryo by herself, as she said, in the freezing, freezing cold. It was hardcore. I was 21, a kid, when I came to Zen Center. I had a traumatic childhood and a lot of trauma still to work through. When I was at Tassajara the first year, I think I cried every period of Zazen. The tears would just be streaming down my face day after day. Dennis Sampson remembers, during Zazen, Peter was sitting on the altar with one leg hanging over the edge from chilblains. Ed would shake and Meg would cry uncontrollably. Lou Hartman was hitting the han for Zazen. It was the third round with all the students sitting quietly as Suzuki approached with his jisha holding the lit stick of incense. Meg came out crying. Like a sheepdog, Suzuki guided her back. She'd go to his side and he'd hold out his stick and guide her back, and she'd go to the other side and his stick would be over there. He kept going forward and she went back in. Meg was hard on herself, but kind to others. When Blanche Hartman first came to Tassajara, Meg was her roommate. I wasn't sure if it was okay for a woman over 45 to be there, said Blanche. Only Catherine Thanis, Pat Harrisoff, and I were that age. There was a sprinkling of people in their 30s, and everybody else was in their 20s. It wasn't clear they wanted somebody around who looked like their mother. Meg made me feel welcome, and I was totally grateful to her. Meg was having tea with Suzuki in his garden. She noticed he was in a particularly playful mood. He showed her a smooth stone he'd found in the creek and pointed out the eye-like design on one side. Mei, he said. Mei is Japanese for eye. He brought out a brush and sumi ink from his cabin and drew a G on the other side. Then he held it up to her and went, Meigu. That's how Meg would be pronounced in Japanese, in which N is the only final consonant. Meigu. Suzuki Roshi's really big teaching to me, she said, was that he treated me as though I were the Buddha. And he actually perceived each of us as the Buddha. I remember thinking to myself, oh gosh, if I'm the Buddha, maybe I'd better start acting like the Buddha. This has been a Gyuk Audio Podcast. I'm DC, Poobah of Gyuk Audio and Gyuk Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Cuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening. ¶¶